I'm busting, Dave. I'm busting. That was incredible. David Rubenstein. When we first decided to start this little project called Big Shot, I remember one of the examples we gave of someone that we would eventually be able to get on the show would be David Rubenstein.
He's the big shot of big shots.
He's like the big shot, right? Yeah. And not only was he thoughtful and interesting, his stories are amazing, but it actually felt like we have so much in common with him. He talked about this amazing story where he was talking to his mom telling him to go be a dentist. And it reminded me of like our own stories and when I told my mom I wasn't gonna be a lawyer anymore, that I was gonna join this little startup with these two or three crazy programmers called Shopify. And my mother's like, But you're a lawyer. Like, why would you want to go be a lawyer? Like,
totally.
You know,
but take the shit bet.
Yeah. That's right. Take it. But the fact that he had the same experience with his parents, I just thought it was amazing. What I loved about him the most was that everything that David Rubenstein does in his life is intentional. The way that he built his business, the way that he parents, the way that he thinks about philanthropy, buying the Magna Carta, all he does, he's so thoughtful about these things. But there's also this layer of chutzpah and ambition. And I mean, he's so inspiring.
When I called my mom, I had had an entrepreneurial venture that didn't work. And I called her. I said, Mom, I'm going into tea. She goes, what? I said, tea. She puts down the phone. She yells, Mel. My dad's name is Mel. She goes, Mel, he's doing tea now. Right? And what's interesting is that, you know, David Rubenstein's mother, for all of his enormous success, what is she most impressed with? It's a free coffee at a major coffee
chain.
That's
right. She goes into Dunkin' Donuts with her free coffee card and she says, you know, my son is the owner of this coffee company. You know, Dunkin' Donuts.
I mean, he started off his life in public office. He was the domestic policy advisor to Jimmy Carter. He has dined with presidents. He has made an enormous fortune in private equity, one of the first people to ever do private equity. And then he goes on and becomes a major philanthropist. And he coins, we're going to delve deep on this idea of patriotic philanthropy, which is very different.
Which is totally different and actually very entrepreneurial in terms of how he thinks about it. But the reason that he decides to build Carlyle, which is now one of the largest private equity funds on the planet, one of the most prestigious, one of the most impactful, the reason he decides to do it, he talks about the way that he thinks about investing, he talks about the things that made Carlyle super, like he kind of gave us a secret sauce of what makes Carlyle so successful.
And what's amazing about it is that he's been in every industry you can think of, and he went from 0 to 100 really quick. I mean, this guy has $300 billion of assets under management, and he immediately started raising
$300 billion
with a B, and he immediately started raising multiple funds at the same time and going into multiple countries very quickly. Very quickly, and here he is today. He's one of the most successful private equity people you can find.
And like all of the big shots we've interviewed, we asked that one question. When did you know that you made it?
Right.
And like all the other big shots, he says,
I still haven't made it. I got lots to do. There's
still
so much to do.
I have lots to do. I look at people like Bill Gates and I say, I don't have enough money. And I look at people like Elon Musk and I say, I haven't done enough. I haven't built enough. Ladies and gentlemen, the big shot of all big shots, we got a chance to sit down and interview David Rubenstein. Incredible interview. We hope you love it.
Let's go.
Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team. Yeah, I done kept it real from the jump.
David, there's no question you're a big shot. Everyone knows you founded Carlyle Group. It's now close to $300 billion in assets under management, 1,800 employees, 31 offices, 6 countries. You're a prolific writer, podcaster, philanthropist. But
here's the question. Why didn't you become a dentist?
Well, I'm not a big shot. My mother had a view. My parents were not college educated, but they always looked up to people who were professionals, and the only professionals they knew were either doctors, dentists, or lawyers. My mother had a number of people in her family who had gone to law school, night law school, and failed the bar exam, so they never actually practiced law, wound up driving taxi cabs. Doctors were always somebody they thought were just, you know, gods, practically. And dentists, my mother thought, that's a greater job than being a doctor because you don't have any emergency hours and people call you doctor. And my mother had a lot of dental problems. She was always paying bills to dentists, so she figured it's a very safe business and you know, you don't have to work on weekends. I just tried to convince her that I would have arthritis in my fingers perhaps if I, you know, at some point in the future, so I would lose my career. So I convinced her that I wasn't going to do that.
So the reason we bring it up, the reason we're joking about it is because before, in prepping for this interview, I went to law school. I didn't really want to be a lawyer. My mom wanted me to be a lawyer. I ended up, you know, building this company.
Actually, something you both have in common is that you're both still members of the bar as a fallback in case the investment thing doesn't work out. And in case
so he asked me that question. He said, are you still paying your bar fees? And I said, I am. And he said, why are you doing it? I said, because it's my mom. My mom likes the idea that even though Shopify is a great big company.
The same thing. Because my mother said, David, when you started Carlisle, David, keep your bar license because they have something to fall back on. So I'm still a member of the DC bar for like 40 years, and I just pay dues. I don't know why.
You never know.
But what is it about? So David as well. Same thing. His parents wanted to be an accountant. What is it about these Jewish parents and grandparents who want all they want for their children is to become professionals?
Well, that's obviously a very historic kind of thing. But you know, Jews who came to this country and Jews who lived in, let's say, Europe. They wanted their children to rise up. Now, in Europe, you couldn't probably do business as readily unless it was just a sole entrepreneurship kind of thing. So a profession, a doctor, a lawyer, so forth, was something you could fall back on. And one of the advantages of that is to be a doctor or a dentist or a lawyer, you have a profession. And once you have that profession, you can leave that country if you're forced out, and you can do it elsewhere. If you have a business and it's only local business and you have to be forced out of the country, you can't take the business with you necessarily. But you can take the doctor skills, the lawyer skills with you. I think that's why Jewish people always put an emphasis on education, because you can pick up your brain and take it anywhere you go. And you can't always do everything the same way with business, so you can't always pick up your business and go. Sometimes you can. In the United States, when Jews started coming here, and the first Jews early were in Charleston, the United States, they were Sephardic Jews, and then when they came to the northern part of the United States, when they were coming from Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazi Jews, they were people who basically had no money at the time. And so they tried to build themselves up and become professionals, because the Jews that first came over, they were peddlers. They had nothing. They were just selling things. And then eventually they realized that if you have a professional career, you don't have to be a peddler, and they didn't want to be peddlers their whole life. So they got their children to want to be doctors, lawyers, dentists, or equivalent.
Yeah. Well, you did become a dentist. You became an incredible lawyer, and you served in the government, and then you went on to start a private equity group. Take us back, though, to your household, the Rubenstein household growing up, with your mom and I believe your dad who worked at the Postal Service.
Well, in Baltimore is one of the most rigidly segregated cities in the United States by ethnicity and by, I would say, religion. In the United States, the Supreme Court in 1948 said, in a case called, I think, Shelley v. Kramer, you can no longer have restrictive covenants. A restrictive covenant means you can't say this house cannot be sold to a Jew or a black. And that was very common in the United States. You weren't allowed to sell homes to people who are Jewish or black, outlawed by the Supreme Court, but Baltimore never quite got the word. And so there's still, if you were Jewish or black, you couldn't really move into certain neighborhoods. And so if you were Jewish and you were not that wealthy, you moved in a certain part of Baltimore where there was no housing, the houses were being built, but only Jews were living there. So in the area that I grew up, it was like a ghetto in the sense that everybody I knew was Jewish. There were no non-Jews in this area. I was probably 13 or 14 before I met somebody who wasn't Jewish. I thought everybody in the world was Jewish, and I realized not that many people were Jewish later. But so it was a blue-collar environment. I looked at my house. It was 800 square feet, two bedrooms, one bathroom, no air conditioning, tiny little backyard. And that's all my father could afford. He had dropped out of high school to go into World War II, came back, met my mother. She dropped out of high school to marry him. He was 20 years old. She was 17. Wow. And they had a blue-collar life, and the only job he really could get was one that didn't require a high school degree, worked in the post office, and basically did that, for entire life. As a blue-collar person, the day he could retire at the age of 55, he retired.
Yeah. And which now seems kind of crazy to retire at 55, right?
I'm 74, an age too young to be president of the United States, but still an advanced age. And even at 74, I'm working as hard as I can. He just said, I can't stand the job I have. And so at 55, he could retire and move to what I call a suburb of Baltimore, West Palm Beach, Florida, mm-hmm. where they moved. But I don't look back and say, well, woe is me. I wish I had been in a wealthier family. I wish my parents had been educated. Maybe at the time I thought it'd be nicer. But as I look back on it, if you don't have a lot of wealth and you don't have the ability of people open doors for you, you have to do it on your own.
Yeah.
So today that I have the skill set to maybe do things on my own, I have much more self-confidence than I would have if my father just handed things to me. Now I have the converse situation with my children. I became reasonably wealthy by normal standards, not by Elon Musk standards, but by normal standards, reasonably wealthy. And my children, as they were growing up, they lived in a reasonably wealthy setting. So how can you give your kids that kind of drive that I had? And it's not easy to do. As I've said, you may have seen me say this, the hardest thing to do in life is to be happy. Personal happiness is the most elusive thing in life. The second hardest thing is probably to raise children who are happy and healthy. Mm-hmm. And third is to raise children happy and healthy when you are yourself wealthy. Because you've probably seen people who are very wealthy, they spoil their children, they do all kinds of things that maybe their children shouldn't be doing, and then ultimately you produce a lot of kids that aren't that driven. So my three children are all in what I call the highest calling of mankind, private equity.
Of course. Right.
They're all driven, they all have their own funds. You know, I help them a little bit, but they're doing pretty well. And so I hope that they, in the end, can survive and do well when I'm gone, because that won't be too long from now. I'm not going to live forever. I hope they all outlive me. But, you know, my legacy ultimately will be my children. You know, I can buy this or buy that or do something. But in the end, people will look at your children and whether you raise them well or not. And people who are Jewish really particularly care about making sure their kids do quite well.
Yeah. Were you just as happy growing up in Baltimore as a poor kid as you are as a wealthy, you know, private equity philanthropist?
And when I was growing up, I didn't aspire to be wealthy. I didn't have any interest in money. I know that sounds strange to you today, but there were no billionaires in the United States in the 1950s. Maybe there was one. And so if you were Jewish, you couldn't aspire to be that wealthy because there were no examples of Jews who were fabulously wealthy. Jews who were in business generally were in their own family business they built. Mm-hmm. If you were a Jewish and you graduated from Harvard or Yale or Princeton or the equivalent, and you wanted to go to Morgan Guaranty or Procter & Gamble or IBM, you probably knew there was a totem pole. You weren't going to be rising to the top of the totem pole because Jews didn't rise up in large corporations. That's why they often set up their own businesses or they went in their family businesses. I look back on it, I guess I was reasonably happy. I didn't mope around and say, woe is me. I wish I had been a better athlete. I wish I'd been smarter. I wish I'd done better in school. I wish a lot of things, but none of the things are associated with not having money so much.
When you were in school, were you motivated to get to do well? Was there a pressure from your parents to say, David, if you're going to do this, do it all? Was there ambition built into the childhood?
It would be nice if I could say yes and my parents pushed me. They didn't. My parents had no great ambition for me. They were not educated. They didn't really necessarily think I had to go to college. They thought if you go to college, fine. But if I had said I want to be the same as my father, work in the post office after high school,
they
would have said fine. Yeah. Whatever you want to do. If I want to say I want to be a shoe salesman, whatever they want, whatever I wanted was fine. They didn't really care, and they didn't have any grand ambition. They never said, you should go to a great college. They didn't really care. When I turned out to be a reasonably good student, they were happy, but they didn't really say, wow, now you're going to be making a lot of money, and now you're going to make us proud. It just wasn't something. They didn't put that kind of pressure on me. There are Jewish parents, and parents who aren't Jewish too, who really push their kids to do well, and they try to live their life through their children. Yeah. And my parents weren't trying to relive their life through me. They were just happy that they had one child and they wanted him to do reasonably well, but they weren't obsessive, compulsive. They weren't a tiger mom or father kind of thing.
And yet you're very driven. So where did that come from? Was it later in life?
I guess my drive, I think, came from that I wanted to just make something of myself. And I was in a youth group in Baltimore, and actually
like BBYO kind of thing?
Well, it was like that. There was a judge in Baltimore who took young Jewish preteen boys and became teenagers. And they ultimately it was a youth group that did athletics. We came to Toronto to play lacrosse, which was the national sport of Canada, as you may know. and we did cerebral things as well. And a lot of the people there were people that I would look up to and say, yes, they're very accomplished. They're going to go to good colleges. But my parents didn't put pressure on me. I think I put pressure on myself to just say, I want to make something with my life and do something, productive. Now, I got lucky in my life. When I went to law school, I got a scholarship. I just spoke to my 50th reunion. And, of course, I looked at everybody and said, wow, they all look old. Of course, they look at me saying they look old, too. But I realized when I went to law school that I was reasonably intelligent, but not a genius. Yeah. If you're really a genius, first in your class in law school, Supreme Court clerk, you might get diverted into being a law professor or something else. And it's often said the A students become law professors, the B students are judges, and the C students probably make money.
Yeah, I was a C student in law school.
Okay, so so you know the phenomenon. When I started practicing law, I realized I wasn't great at it. I was okay.
What was it about it that you weren't great at? Was it the details of this micro? Was it were you on the wrong side of the table?
I think that I was interested in the time when I was starting to practice law, I was really interested in politics. I went to practice law, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison, a unique firm that was half Jewish, half not Jewish, and had a lot of political people in it, like Ted Sorensen had been John Kennedy's top advisor.
Whose speech really inspired you,
the inaugural drafts, yeah, among other things. And so I really wanted to go into politics. I had no interest in making money. I know today people say, how can you say that? I was only interested in politics and government, not as a candidate, but being an advisor like Ted Sorensen had been to Kennedy. And so he helped me get a job in Washington, ultimately led to the campaign in Carter. Carter got elected president. I went along for the ride, and I'm in the White House, and this is all I wanted to do. So I worked around the clock for 7 days. I loved it. I wasn't married, and I just loved it. And then we lost the election.
Right.
I remember telling Jimmy Carter, you don't have to worry about re-election, Mr. President, because you got hostages, yes, and you got gas lines, yes, and inflation's high, but Ronald Reagan is 69 years old. Nobody that old can get elected president.
But a different time.
Well, 69 seemed like a teenager. Yeah. Let's find a candidate that's 69 years old. So I didn't think anybody 69. When I turned 69, I thought, oh, my God, I'm still young. But people, anyway. So when I had to go back and practice law again, I didn't like it. And, you know, nobody ever won a Nobel Prize hating what they do. You have to love what you do to really make success of it. And I didn't really like the practice of law because what is it? It was in law school, it was seen as a profession. Yeah. And when I got there, it was a business. Every month, the partnership meeting is how much money we made this month, how much money can we make next month? It was not about the great principles of law. And so I figured if I'm really going to be in business, which is what law firm world is, I should be in a business where I can make more money than the law business. Yeah. But I didn't really aspire to make a lot of money. When I started the company, Carlisle, I'll never forget, I said to the leasing agent, look, I'm going to start a 10-person firm. The most will be 10 people. And she said, okay, we have leasing space for that. And she said, but we have a special thing here. You can have an option for another 5,000 square feet. It's free. You know, the option's free. We add it in. I don't want it. She said, it doesn't cost anything. I said, I don't want to be tempted to have more than 10,000 square feet or another 5,000 square feet. I don't want to be tempted to grow. So I thought it would be a tiny little firm.
How many square feet today?
It's more than we need, probably, because nobody comes in the office
anymore.
We can talk all about that as well. We have space everywhere, and nobody shows up anymore because everybody's working home.
Yeah. Right. I do have a question, though. You know, one thing that is obvious when I research you, when I talk to you, and David and I are kind of like this, too. We have kind of this thing that my mother, my bubby, would say, we're sitting on Spilkes, meaning like we're always going. We have 10 different things going at any one time. There was a period of time, David, where between Carter losing the election and you actually starting Carlisle, where you were kind of unemployed.
Well, it was a different period of time.
6 months.
What happened was this. Carter lost the election.
Yeah.
So Carter said, okay, I'm going to do all the things I wanted to get done administratively. Started working around the clock getting things done administratively. I'm saying, what about my career? And what am I going to do next? And so all the people used to come to me and say, you're a bright young man. If you ever want a job, call me up. I started calling them. And they said, well, maybe we meant when Carter was president, we'd like you. And now that Reagan's president, well, we really don't want you.
Because your brand was connected to Carter in that way?
Well, the theory was, what do Washington lawyers really do? They're selling access to a large extent. I mean, they're serious litigators and other kinds, but a lot of the kind of, if you work in the White House, you're really a guy selling access to the White House. So when Carter was president, people said, if you want to quit and, quote, sell access to Carter and Carter administration, you can do that. I didn't really want to do that because I thought Carter would get reelected. I'd be the senior domestic advisor in the second term, just like Ted Sorensen had been. But obviously, the voters heard that. They didn't want that to happen. So I left. And then all the people told me how great I was. They didn't want to hire me. And so it was somewhat embarrassing, humiliating to say, all right, I'm a guy that went to a good law school, went to a good law firm, work in the White House, and all of a sudden, I'm nothing. And, you know, so I did a lot of interviews, and a lot of people said, hey, you're a really nice guy. Let me think of somebody who might need you, but it wasn't them. So there were no great firms that wanted me. All the big famous firms didn't want me. Finally, some modest-sized firm felt sorry for me, I guess, and they had me come in not as I expected to be a partner, but as a senior associate, and if I did well in a year or two, maybe they'd make me a partner.
So they all said to you, you're fabulous, you're smart, we love you, but we're not hiring you.
Well, the practice of law is one where you have to specialize. You either have a specialty or you don't. And the years when my law school classmates were learning how to be lawyers. I was at the White House, or I was working on Capitol Hill. So my classmates are becoming lawyers, and I'm sort of, you know, I'm just having a good time in the White House. I didn't really have the legal skills, so I didn't have a specialization. If I was an energy expert or I was a securities expert, maybe somebody would have hired me, but I was a generalist.
Yeah, right.
And so I didn't want to tell my mother, look, your only child has no employment and he's unemployable. I kept saying, I have
should
so many.
Should have been a dentist.
I should have said, look, I have so many offers, I don't know which one to take. And after about 4 months of this, 5 months of this, she said, David, just take one of those offers.
Right.
Finally, somebody made me this offer. I took it. I think I started in June of the year after we lost the election. And then I started practicing law, and I realized the practice of law is the two things. You're either doing the work or you're getting the clients. Yeah. And those people who get the clients generally get rewarded more than the people who do the work. Mm-hmm. So I started figuring out how to get clients by selling whatever service I had or selling my law firm. But after a while, I realized, look, this isn't what I want to do for my life. And just selling access and selling, you know, my services, I didn't like it. So I started a private equity firm, and I didn't really think it would be more than a modest firm, but it turned out to be
well, let's very let's talk successful. About how yeah. you got the inspiration to start the firm. We were doing our research for this interview. One of the most interesting stories we came across was, originally, you were seeing a firm as getting a bunch of finance guys, and yourself as a legal person, you'd be the lawyer
right,
for
correct.
The firm. And then you heard about, I believe it was William Simon, the deputy treasury secretary who started Gibson Greeting Card Company.
That's correct.
Right? Sorry, he bought it for $1 million worth of equity and $80 million of debt, and then took an IPO around $300 million.
Essentially, that's right. What happened was, in the early days of private equity, this is hard to believe, you would put in 1% equity and you'd put in 99% debt. And sometimes the 1% equity we would take out as a fee. So you had no money, you take out the 1% as a fee. So Bill Simon, who had started a company called Westray, he did a deal where they bought Gibson greeting cards from RCA.
And it was sort of like Hallmark kind of thing?
Yes, it's like Hallmark, a junior version of it. And it was like, I think they paid $234 million or something like that. And he put in $1 million of his own money. And in about 18 months, he paid $80 million. Now remember, and these are the days when you're highly levered and the sellers are relatively unsophisticated. They're selling things at 6 and 7 times cash flow, not 15 times cash flow. And with that much leverage, it doesn't take a lot to make the thing work.
And $80 million then, inflation adjusted, is...
It's a staggering amount of money. So I went down the street to Bill Miller, who was the Secretary of Treasury in the Carter years, and said, your predecessor, Bill Simon, just did a leverage buyout. Why don't you start a leverage buyout firm and I'll be your legal advisor? Now, I think he realized I wasn't a great lawyer, so he demurred and didn't really want to do that. So then I went to some other people and said, why don't we start a firm and I'll be the lawyer for it. And nobody really wanted to do that. And I tried to get people to come together. And then finally, a guy who had been one of my clients, he was the head of Marriott of Texas, he came to me one day and said, I finally figured out how you can start this firm. I said, how? I said, who did you find you want to do it with? I was trying to pair him up with somebody. He said, I'm going to do it with you. I said, no, I'm a lawyer. He said, no, you can learn how to do this. So I gave him an office next to mine in the law firm, and we started plotting how to put this together. And then we ultimately went out and hired some people. And then I had to go out and raise the money. I didn't have any fundraising experience, but a guy who helped me from T. Rowe Price helped me raise $5 million. And that's all we had to start.
Wow. Which is impressive because T. Rowe is a fairly conservative firm, right?
And for very you to conservative.
Be, for you to have no track record, you're a lawyer,
correct.
A good lawyer.
Well,
a lawyer nonetheless. And how did you get T. Rowe?
Well, this person is Ed Mathias, and he's still at Carlisle now. He was a person who was very good at connecting people. And when I was at the White House, he connected with me, and I made some speeches that organizations involved with, so he knew me. And he kept in touch with me, as he does with many other people like me at the time. And so he said he had some investors. T. Rowe Price, he was a senior person there. He could convince him to put it was only $1.25 million. Then Alex Brown, which is also in Baltimore, close to T. Rowe Price, $1.25 million. Then the Mellon family he had known, and they got them in. And then First Interstate Bank in California, later bought by another bank. So it was $1.25 million, 4 people. And ultimately, the Mellons bought the others out because they weren't that interested in doing this. I'll give you an example. One of the first deals we were going to do was an unfriendly kind of deal where we were trying to bear hug a company, which is to say we want to take you private and take you from being a public. And the company was called Chi-Chi's. Well, we kind of bear hugged them a bit. And it turned out that Alex Brown was trying to get them to be and one of their advisors, one of their investment banking clients. So Alex Brown said, wait a second,
I can't do this.
We're investing with you and you're trying to take over a company that we're trying to take. So they kind of wanted to get out. And ultimately, the Mellon family bought everybody out and they owned 20% of us for quite a while.
Wow.
And then we ultimately bought them out, but it was one of their best investments ever. They owned 20% of us for quite a while and it did well.
And but it didn't go so well at first, right? I think we had some deals
that didn't work so well because we didn't know what we were doing so much. But we bought some companies, but we had a style that wasn't probably working so wonderfully. In those days, sometimes you did a bear hug. A bear hug means you buy 5% of a company, you go to them and say, we wanted to buy the whole company. And we didn't want to do what's called green mailing, which is to say, you buy our stock back, but we'd like to take the company and make it available for sale. We might buy it or somebody else might buy it. The problem is the first deal we did was Chi-Chi's. We went to see the CEO. And we only had enough money to buy.
What kind of company is that?
It was a Mexican restaurant company.
Chain.
Mexican food chain. So I went to the CEO. The four of us went, the four partners went down there. We saw the CEO. We thought he'd throw us out of his office. He never heard of us. And we said we own 5% of your company. We're going to file a document tomorrow. And he said, and we expect him to say, get the hell out of this office. I don't want to be going private. And I never heard of you guys. He said, thank God somebody like you showed up. I don't really be a public company.
Wow.
Let's go private. Of course, we didn't have enough money to do it. Anyway, enough for 5%. So we went.
So wait, you own 5%. It gives you some clout to be able to influence the board. And you come and you say, we want to go private.
Right.
And
he's like,
bluff.
All right, let's do it. And then you're like,
we don't have
95% of the money.
So we went out. In those days, there was a man who had invented the ability to create money. Just like Picasso could put his signature on a painting and it's money good, right?
Or a napkin. Yeah.
Or when Henry Kaufman was the chief economist of Salomon Brothers, he would say the stock market's going down. You knew in advance, if you knew that, you could bet it the way he told you was going, you would make money. Mike Milken had invented a way of creating money. He basically had invented the high yield so-called junk bond, and he had invented a way to kind of perfect it for people like us by saying, I'll give you a highly confident letter that I can raise the money. And all you have to do is show this letter to an investment banker and he'll know that the money will be good.
He was the bond king, right? Yeah.
Right, he was everything. And so we went to see him at like 4 a.m. because he met early in the day.
This is when Milken would meet people at 4 o'clock
in the morning? 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, yes. So we both show up there and this was the great Mike Milken. I now know him pretty well, but then I didn't know him. And we started to make our little pitch. He said, Mexico is a great country. It's going to be a really terrific country in the future. I said, no, this is Mexican food. It's not Mexico. But he didn't quite get it, and he kept talking about Mexico, and I said, okay, this is not going to work. And then he left the room, and then we explained it to the other guys. And he signed us to an investment banker named Leon Black, and he was our investment banker.
Wow.
And he ultimately said, guys, you don't really know what you're doing. Let me get somebody else to take over this deal for you. But anyway, so we did a number of deals, and ultimately some of them worked out. And
this is a tiny deal.
Tiny. It was a tiny deal.
And like, this isn't Chipotle we're talking about here. This is Chi-Chi's, right?
Tiny.
Yeah.
But what happened, the reason the firm grew was not that I was so brilliant or so talented. That was certainly not the case. I had an idea, and that idea enabled us to grow. And here's what it is. In the early days of private equity, you had a private equity fund or a venture capital fund or a debt fund or a real estate fund. You only did that. That's all you did. And you did it only in your own country. So if you were a KKR, which is an early buyout fund, they only had 6-7 people. They're tiny, tiny firms, but they just did buyouts. Or if you're a venture capital firm, you just did venture. I said, why don't we do like Fidelity or T. Rowe Price, have multiple funds doing many different things, each fund, and then centralize fundraising, legal, tax, accounting at the center, and therefore we'd have these funds, and so do you. If you're a buyout investor with us, give us a chance in venture. If you're a buyout and venture investor, give us a chance in real estate. So we would basically do that, and that was the idea, have multiple funds, and then the second idea was to globalize it. In those days, the early private equity firms all did things only in their own country. If you're in Europe, you only did Europe. If you're in America, only in America. I said, let's get a dedicated group in Europe, dedicated group in Asia, Japan, Latin America, Middle East, Africa. And I went around the world and recruited these people, and then I would raise money for the funds, and then I have my partners oversee the investments. So that's what enabled us to grow.
But what's your track record at this point? So you have this grand vision.
Right.
Which ended up materializing and becoming an enormous success. But when you first conceived this idea of raising multiple funds at the same time across multiple geographies, how successful are you?
Well, let's say anybody that's an entrepreneur, take Shopify as a good example. When Shopify was getting built, how many people said, this is never going to work, Amazon?
Right. TAM is too small. We're not in the right place. The e-commerce trend is not going to last, of course.
Look, when Facebook was getting started, it was started by a Harvard undergraduate named Mark Zuckerberg. He was the classmate of my now son-in-law. And he told me about this company. I said, look, this is a dating service. It's not going anywhere.
And you had seen dating services, I think, in the 60s.
Yeah, and they don't go anywhere. They go bankrupt.
And I believe you had a similar situation with Jeff Bezos.
Right, same thing. A Bezos company.
We could own 20%.
We could have owned 20% of it, but we turned it down because we didn't really think it was going to go anywhere. Anyway, so I've turned down a lot of great things. But my point is that entrepreneurs, if they dream about something, by definition, if it's really different and unusual, people will say no. Yeah. Because if everybody's doing it, it would be nothing left to do. But if people thought it was a great idea to do Amazon or do Facebook, presumably people would have done it before. Yeah. Every entrepreneur has to beat down the doors of somebody to convince them that it's going to work. Yeah. I'm sure it's true with Shopify, yeah, but anything, Apple.
But you, it sounds like you went from zero to 100 very quickly. Like you didn't start with one fund and then another fund and then another fund. In one
there was
country,
real yeah, chutzpah another, there.
Right,
there was
like you just dove right in. Well, you're like, we're going to do 10 things at the same
time. I went out to raise a $200 million fund and I couldn't raise it. So, you declare victory by saying, I really only wanted to raise $100 million. So I raised $100 million. So then after that $100 million, what we would do is this. We would say, all right, we'll put five in from the fund for a deal, and then we'll co-invest or get outside investor to put another 15. And so after a couple of years, we had co-invested 630 alongside the 100. So we'd raised seven, we had invested 730. So I said, okay, we did 730, we should go raise a $1 billion fund. Yeah. Now it's actually 10 times bigger than we really had as our fund, yeah, but I could convince people we actually could invest in 730. Yeah. And the track record turned out to be reasonably good. Yeah. And that's because one of the partners I brought in was really a pretty solid investor, and we pretty much knew what we were doing, relatively speaking. We weren't perfect, mm-hmm, but we made mistakes for sure.
One of the things I want to ask you about is, you talk about obviously building Carlyle. You talk about, your relationships, your philanthropy. And we want to talk about philanthropy a little bit also, because it's very important. In fact, a mutual friend, Laura Lauder, who's kind of mentoring me now in sort of philanthropy, uses you as an example about patriotic philanthropy, right, okay, and how that works. And I want to hear more about that. But there is this one thing that I'm curious about, which is your level of ambition today, David, is so remarkable. What did your mother say as you're dining with presidents, as you're becoming a billionaire? Right. Like, what did mom and dad, what would Bubby and Zadie have said?
Getting honored at the Met.
What would they say about this?
Well, they didn't really understand a lot of this because they just were in a different world.
Right.
If it was an article about me in the newspaper, somebody might send it to my mother and she'd be proud of it and so forth. And my father was really not as excited. He just didn't know, they didn't really understand this world. Now, when I worked in the White House and took them to see President Carter, they see the President of the United States, a big deal to them. But as I became wealthier and better known, they were surprised that I was successful. What can you say? When you raise somebody from a kid that's, you change his diapers, and then all of a sudden he's meeting with presidents or making a lot of money, you say, how can this possibly be? It's just like they knew all my faults, I guess. So my parents were not bragging about it. My mother didn't brag about it, so she was not a bragging type person. The things that she was most impressed with is when we bought a company called Dunkin' Donuts, which is a coffee company,
sure,
really. And then
we have Tim Hortons here.
Yeah, so I gave her some passes. She got free coffee. So she would go into the local Dunkin' Donuts and say, my son owns Dunkin' Donuts. and the sales lady
would
say,
that's a real big shot move, right?
Sure. My mom used to do that at every David's Tea Store.
They roll their eyes and say, no, my son gave me a little certificate, free coffee. And said, sure, lady, sure.
Okay.
So, she didn't brag about it, but right, she didn't.
Did she comment about the service? Like, David, I went into the Dunkin' on 34th and 7th. And
well, she did. She usually was happy. She's very easy to please. But they were not in the world of traveling with famous people and meeting famous people. So they would read articles about me. But interesting, when my mother did pass away, I went in and got all of her possessions and so forth. And she kept every article about me relating to my philanthropy.
Wow.
So what she did is she didn't really care that much about the business success or the money, but she took all the things of philanthropy. And my mother didn't have money, and she didn't know what the word philanthropy really meant. She knew what charity meant. She knew that. But as a woman who had no money, she apparently couldn't resist a request for money. So when she passed away, I got all of her mail forwarded to me. And I get 100 letters a day from every Alzheimer's Association or Diabetes Association or St. Jude's, because she gave $5 or $10
wow,
to everyone every year. And so it gets on the mailing list. And now I'm on the mailing list on her behalf. And she was giving away the little money she had. I gave her a fair amount of money when I became wealthy, but she didn't want it. And she just would say, I don't need the money, I don't want money. But whatever I give her, she would mostly give away.
Was she alive when you signed the giving pledge?
Yes.
She was. Yeah. And the giving pledge for everybody watching is you're committed to give away half of your money.
Well, yes and no. The giving pledge was something created by Warren Buffett and Bill and Melinda Gates. It was modeled on Chuck Feeney, who passed away recently. Chuck Feeney was one of the founders of duty-free shops, and he apparently gave away $9 or $10 billion. And he had started a company called General Atlantic. They were very successful. He took all his profits from that and gave it away. He gave away all of his money, $9 or $10 billion, and lived on $5 million for him, his family, and his four kids. He didn't want money. He lived cheaply. He just passed away, sadly, about a week or so ago. He was the model for it. The way it works is you have to have a net worth of $1 billion, and then you have to give away or commit to give away half of your net worth upon your death or during your lifetime. Now, it's voluntary. So if you say, look, I'd like to be in the giving pledge, I'd like to hang out with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, I'm going to give it all away when I die, and then you die and you don't give it away, we can't disinter you, right? So, but we try to get people that are, you know, really are giving
away. That's kind of a bad thing to do. Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, from an integrity perspective.
Right.
Like,
your words are bond.
You know, and when I first went to the first meeting, I said, okay, I'm going to meet the richest people in the United States who are giving away this money. And I thought I'm going to meet these people that are all well-dressed and they're all really looking like, you know, right out of Hollywood as a CEO. They're all older people, you know, they look like they're people that you wouldn't have predicted. These people started great companies 50 years ago, 40 years ago. Now they're older and they're giving away their money. Now we have recruited younger people. Mark Zuckerberg is an equivalent. But, wealthy people, increasingly, when you get a lot of money, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
You can build a pyramid to yourself what the pharaohs did, but is that going to make you better? I don't know.
Yeah.
You either have to give it away to your children, which is the most common thing people do, their spouse and their children, or you give it away to some other cause or project, and that you either do upon your death or during your lifetime. And I have concluded that better to give it away during your lifetime. You can see the benefits of it, because I'm not sure I'm going to go to some place where I'm going to be able to look down and see what people are doing with my money. So I am trying to give away. I've given away a lot of my net worth, and I tend to give away a lot more. Yeah. And I keep saying to my children, I'm giving away all my money so that they hear these speeches and they realize maybe they should work hard so they won't
they can
wait for
themselves.
Me to die.
Well, you know, you don't know this, I haven't told you this yet, but as we're modeling how we want to sort of give away, we don't have money like you have, but we have a little bit of money now to give away. You actually described a bit of a philosophy around philanthropy, which is you want to be a part of something where if it wouldn't start without you, it wouldn't end without you. It's deeply personal, and I think you can see the actual
benefits in my lifetime.
The benefits in your lifetime, right? And those four criteria. My wife and I have now adopted those. I want to talk about your philosophy around philanthropy, and particularly as it connects to, I mean, you're on all these boards. In fact, Laura Lauder said one thing that's funny about David is David was chairman of Yale, I believe.
No, Duke.
Duke, while your children all went to Harvard. And just to show that, like, it wasn't just about, you know, helping your children. It was places where you could have an impact. There is a particular way that you give away money, David, which has this sort of leverage impact philosophy. And I assume the reason you're on so many boards and you chair so many boards is because you want to actually see the efficacy of it. You want to actually be strategic about it. Is that how you think about philanthropy?
Well, philanthropy is a word that's derived from an ancient Greek word that means loving humanity. And you can love humanity by doing many things, but one of the best ways to help other people is giving your most valuable resource, which is your time. You can make more money if you're in the business world and you're inclined to make money. You can't make more time. It's a finite thing. Everybody's got a limited amount of it. So I think that one of the best things I can do to help people is to give my time. So I have overdosed on nonprofit boards. I'm probably on 23 or 4, and I chair now, I think, 7 of them. So large boards. And I like to do that because I can make the organization go in a certain direction. I can feel I'm giving my time as well as my money. Obviously, if you're chair of a board, you're going to be giving a lot of money, too. Sure. You probably wouldn't be the chairman of the board. Yeah. I am not any different than many other people who get lucky in making money, give money to universities that gave me scholarships or hospitals or other kinds of things, medical causes. Everybody thinks they're going to solve cancer if they give money to some cancer institution. But I stumbled into what I call now patriotic philanthropy. Now, if I'd hired McKinsey and said, how can I give back to the country that made it possible for me to be so lucky, they would probably have come up with some projects and I would probably have ignored them all. But I, like many things in life that are good, it happens by serendipity. I'm minding my own business. I worked in Washington, I lived in Washington, but I'm minding my own business. I didn't have any patriotic philanthropy concept. And then somebody invited me to go look at a viewing of something called the Magna Carta. Now, I know enough about Miss History to know what the Magna Carta is. I had not actually seen it or been that interested in it. It was only a couple blocks away from my office in Washington. I'd never been over to the one copy in the United States. Turns out there's 17 extant copies, 15 in British institutions, one in the Australian Parliament, and Rossborough had bought one that a family had sold because they were land poor, and he brought it to the United States and paid in, I think, about $1.2 or $3 million in 1984. He put it up for sale. The curator at
Sotheby's. Why did he put it up for sale? Rossborough doesn't need
because
money.
I think he got in a little bit of a dispute with the National Archives where he had placed it, and he then therefore said, I wanted to sell it so I could have revenue to money to give to Iraqi war veterans.
Okay.
So but he probably had other money, too.
For people listening, Magna Carta, I believe, is a contract from the 13th century between King John, was it, and
right.
the barons. But it was ultimately a failed contract that ended up in the Barons' War. Like, they broke, it restricted the power of the king, but I believe he broke the contract, ultimately.
Well, yes. So, all right. Yeah. The famous thing that everybody knows about is Magna Carta 1215, right? And King John, who was such a bad king, no other king of England's ever taken that name again. There's only one King John. He basically agreed to this thing. He was trying to get revenue to go back and recapture part of his territory that was lost in France. Mm-hmm. To do that, he was trying to tax the barons. Barons said no. They went to war. The Archbishop of Canterbury orchestrated a compromise, and the compromise was the Magna Carta, which said essentially that the barons had certain rights of habeas corpus, punishment had to be proportionate to the crime, things like that, and no taxation without representation, you're going to affect, say, so they would be involved in whether it's going to be taxation. It had a number of provisions in there that are applicable to people who are Jewish, because it said if you owe money to people who are Jewish, you don't really have to pay it so quickly. Why is that? Well, the Jews had to be moneylenders in England because they weren't allowed to do a lot of professions, so they were moneylenders, and a lot of the barons owed money to the Jewish moneylenders, and they kind of stuck in there a provision that said, well, if you owe money to people who are Jewish, maybe you don't have to pay it so quickly. Now, there were now King John in 1215, he put a provision in there, or provision was put in that said that a council of barons could overrule whatever the king said. So if the barons in a council said, King, you're wrong, we're not going to listen, that was the law under the Magna Carta. Well, that meant something that was very significant. Kings were thought to be ruling from God. And if you can overrule a king, what about the Pope? You could overrule the Pope. And the Pope didn't like the concept that you could overrule somebody who's got power from God. So he said to the King John, if you don't abrogate this, I will excommunicate you. So King John, probably looking for an excuse, get out of it anyway. He didn't like the deal because the barons could overrule him. He got out of it. They went to war. He died in the war. His 8-year-old son became the king under a regent. And ultimately, there were several other versions of the Magna Carta. And I bought one of them. That's the only one that went into effect legally, 1297. It's the only one in private hands. There's no provision about Jews in that one. Now, I said, why is that? Maybe they liked the Jews better in 1297 than 1215. Turned out they kicked all the Jews out of England in 1207.
There were no Jews anyway.
There were no Jews to worry about.
Yeah. Ironically, now a Jew bought the actual Magna Carta, which is amazing.
Right.
But what happened is, when I bought that document, I went to Sotheby's. I'd never been to Sotheby's before. I won the auction. They said, you want to hide who you are and you step out the side door or let these reporters know? And I said, no, I'll tell them. I went out and said, look, I came from modest means. I want to give back to the country. I'm going to give this to the country as a modest down payment on my obligation back to the country. And so I started saying, well, okay, maybe I should buy some other historic documents. And I started buying copies of Emancipation Proclamation, Declaration of Independence, and I put them in places that people would see them. And the theory was, people don't know much about history, and if you see an actual document, you're more likely to appreciate it and understand it than you are if you just look on a computer slide. The human brain has not yet evolved such that if you look at a computer slide of the Magna Carta, you get the same thing as if you go in person, you have a curator explain it to you, you read a book about it later because you've actually seen it in person. So I started buying these historic documents, put them on display, and then the Washington Monument had its earthquake damage, and I said to the head of the Park Service, how much is it going to take to fix it? He said, I'm not sure yet. I said, you got the money? He said, no, I'll get it from Congress, it'll take a couple years. I said, forget Congress, I'll put up the money. And so people were stunned, to my amazement, that a private citizen would fix the Washington Monument.
Did you get to put your initials in it?
I did go up to the top and do that when I went up to the top. But I started fixing historic buildings on the same theory. The Jefferson Memorial, Lincoln Memorial, Mount Vernon, Thomas Jefferson's house, the Monticello, James Madison's house at Montpelier. And I started doing that on the theory that make these places more attractive, more people come, more people learn about American history. And then one day I just came up with the idea of calling it patriotic philanthropy. All philanthropy is really patriotic. This was just philanthropy designed to remind people of the history and heritage of our country. So it's a large part of my philanthropy, but not the only part of it. Right. And it's something that when my obituary is written, they'll probably say, Mr. Right. Patriotic Philanthropy. But it's really designed to educate people. That's why I do it.
Yeah. And for everybody listening, David, you've given not just patriotic philanthropy, but the more traditional hundreds of millions of dollars right. to academic institutions. But let's go back a second, not to the giving away of the money, but the making of the money and the early days of Carlisle. What was your first big deal?
Well, we bought an aerospace company that did pretty well. It was spun out of another aerospace company. We had brought in I had recruited Frank Carlucci. See, nobody ever heard of me at those days, so I wanted to get people who people would have heard of. So I brought in Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of Defense, and he had credibility in the aerospace industry, and that was a good concept. So 4 years later, Jim Baker was available, the great Secretary of State. So I brought him in, and he said, what about my friend George Herbert Walker Bush? We brought him in, and he said, what about my friend John Major? So we brought him in, and so we had a lot of ex-government people, and so therefore
ex-government people, and ex-president too, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So we basically, could get in to see a lot of people. Now, if I invited you to see me in London at a dinner, David Rubenstein is going to make a talk about the U.S. economy, nobody would show up. If I say George Herbert Walker Bush is going to make a speech about whatever you want to talk about,
everybody
show up. So it was an effective fundraising device. It wasn't illegal or immoral, but it was effective to get people to come and listen to
us. But they also wanted, presumably they were also leaving government, leaving D.C. They wanted to know what's next. Some of these people had not made a lot of money yet, right?
I mean, you didn't go from Chi-Chi's to this massive aerospace company, did you?
Well, we had some smaller deals, but it wasn't that massive. These were not billion-dollar deals. These were $100 million deals. And we did okay. Look, everybody gets a deal or two that turns out well, and you get lucky, and you build on that. And we had some deals that didn't work out as well. If you're in the deals business, you're going to lose money on deals from time to time. But if you do reasonably well, you more deals will work out than not. And our investors got to be, happy with us. And I was not. I didn't go to get an MBA. So I wish I had a JD MBA. My son has one. All of my other children have MBAs. I don't have one. So I didn't have the finance skills. So I said, what are you going to do? In any organization, to make yourself useful, even if you're the founder, you have to come up with something that makes yourself useful. Otherwise, people will kick you out. Yeah. So I came up with the idea of becoming the fundraiser for the firm because nobody else wanted to do it.
On the LP side, running like the fundraiser on in like the limited partners that you're
raise the money.
Capital.
Yeah. No, it's the way all these deals work. You have to go out and raise money from limited partners.
Yeah.
So my partners were doing the deals. I said, okay, I'll go out and schlep around the world and ask people for money. And it was okay in the United States. And I started trying Europe. Then eventually I was going to the Middle East. I'd never been to the Middle East. And Jim Baker joined our firm. He said, well, David, it's not a problem if you're Jewish. If you're Israeli, it could be a little challenging to go to Saudi Arabia. I remember the first time I went to Saudi Arabia, I get off the plane and Jim Baker gets off before me, and I thought they were going to say, hey, Jim Baker, thank you for coming, and what'd you bring this Jewish guy for? But they didn't say that. And actually, now I've been in the Middle East, for 30 years, and I know the place pretty well, and I go to Israel, and I go to all the major Arab countries that have money for this kind of thing, and they're large investors with us, but with other firms too. I'm not even invented the idea of getting there.
One of the things that David and I are fascinated by is this concept of building sort of 100-year companies. And as we were researching Carlisle, you said this so well earlier. You said you were able to bring in the best and the brightest to come work with you, whether it was George W. Bush.
H.W.
Bush.
H.W. Bush. H.W. is the original.
Or it was defense secretaries or these incredible people came to work with you in Carlisle. It seems, though, that continuity has continued. There's a longevity to it. If you look at the people now who work at Carlisle, they're also the most exceptional people. We're so curious about how do you continue to have longevity at a fund and a firm, and frankly, a brand like Carlisle that is not cool in the 80s but not in the 90s, but rather has a staying power. What's the secret to
obviously,
this?
If you do reasonably well, make money, then you can afford to bring in some people. If you're in Washington, D.C., and you leave government, you don't have that many options to make a fair amount of money if you want to stay in the Washington area because it's not a place where investment banks or commercial banks are. So by being able to say you can be getting the kind of profits that private equity firms can get and live in Washington still, people were interested in, and we became very profitable for some of these people that joined us. In the end, you know, other people came up with the same idea, and other government officials now leave, and they often go to other firms. I mean, David Petraeus went to KKR. Yeah. All the firms are doing the same thing. It's no longer something we have to ourselves. But it worked out well because we were pretty profitable, and we knew what we were doing in the end. It took us a while to get there.
How do you think about sharing those profits with your partners? How do you think about making others around you wealthy?
Well, everybody participates in this. Everybody gets something. I mean, I wasn't the kind of person who said, look, it was my idea to start the company. I'm going to get the lion's share of the profits. I took the early guys, and we all made ourselves equal partners, and we shared it. Now, I'm not as wealthy as some of the people that created these firms because I gave away a lot more of the wealth to people in the firms. Some of the people that started these private equity firms own much more of it than I do of my firm, and they've done better in some ways. So I'm not complaining about my net worth, but I would say we spread the wealth a bit, and it worked out reasonably well, and we're happy with it.
Something you said that I found very interesting is you don't want to hire geniuses. Which is a little bit counterintuitive. Usually you think you want to hire the smartest person in the room, and right. You're like, no, we want to hire reasonably smart people, not geniuses.
But geniuses are people, like I just finished reading and interviewed the author of the book on Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk is an incredibly brilliant man who's built a lot of great companies, but difficult to manage, let's mm-hmm. say. And maybe you could say he's a genius. Steve Jobs, probably a genius, but difficult to manage. So if you're in the business of growing a firm and you can't manage geniuses because they all are so unique that they have their own ideas and you're probably not going to get them to do things. So what I want is people who are reasonably intelligent, but not so much so that they're off the charts and they're difficult to work with for other people.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about sort of the plight of the Jewish people, Jewish entrepreneurship in specific. Right. As a percentage of the population, Jews make up a tiny, tiny percentage. I mean, it's almost laughable. But in terms of impact, particularly in business and subsequently in philanthropy,
right.
Their impact is so much bigger. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I mean, if I ask people, what percentage of the population in the world is Jewish, you know, you get...
Under 1%.
Yeah. Right. What is the percentage? It's 0.2%, I think, is the global population. In the United States, and the total population of Jews in the world is 13 million or something like that.
Right.
So maybe half in Israel and about half... or almost half of the United States and a few in other places,
around, yeah.
Not that much. Nobody knows the answer to this. There's lots of the books have been written about it. Why are Jews, relatively speaking, pretty talented? Why have they won 20% of the Nobel Prizes when they're 0.2% of the population? Nobody really knows. I'm not going to have the answer today. I would say that Jews have valued education over the years, though other groups do too, but they've valued education. They are maybe driven because they're always afraid somebody's going to move to get them kicked out of the country, and they have to have a lot of things in their brain so that if they have to leave, they can take their greatest asset, their brain, with them. Nobody really knows why that is. But as to philanthropy, I think Jews have a historic tradition of helping other people, and they are very large donors to the philanthropic organizations. There are a couple organizations I am involved with, and I say to them, well, look, you know, they say, well, how can we raise more money? I said, well, you have nobody Jewish on your board, not one Jew. I said, well, get somebody Jewish, and then maybe they make some changes. Jews tend to give away a larger percentage of their net worth than non-Jews. I mean, I think that's just empirical data. I don't know that I have the answer to it. I think it's that Jews are always thinking they ought to help other people. They always realize that they have had a lot of challenges in their life, and that they want to help other people also have challenges in their life, I guess.
We've had some guests talk about the fact that, you know, Jews couldn't get into the hospital, so they built Mount Sinai.
Right.
Now Mount Sinai's are everywhere.
Right. We didn't write an op-ed.
That's right. Jews couldn't necessarily get into medical schools, so they built their own medical schools.
Right.
That seems to be almost entrepreneurial in some ways, where if the system is not created and helpful to me, I'm just going to create my own sort of system.
Jews have historically tried to integrate into society, and it has often backfired. In Germany, before World War II, the prominent Jews were integrated into society. They didn't want to be wearing traditional Jewish clothing. They didn't want to look like they were different.
Yeah.
And then they thought that when Hitler came along, he would say, well, they're integrated in society. There's no difference. We're no different than the non-Jews. But in the end, that didn't happen. And, you know, in the end, if you say, I'm not that Jewish, well, when Hitler came along, he didn't say, oh, you're not that Jewish, okay, you stand here. Oh, you're very Jewish, you stand here. You have any Jewish blood, you're seen as Jewish. And so I think that there's always been a situation where Jews always feel that they have to be different. They're going to be treated differently no matter how integrated they are in a society. And Jews would build their own hospitals, their own universities, their own other kinds of facilities because they weren't sure that they could use the other ones. Take country clubs. There are country clubs today in the United States which are still prohibited, not prohibited. They don't really don't have any Jewish members. You can say in this day and age, in places like Palm Beach or New York area, there are still clubs that won't take Jews. The Jews built their own country clubs. The discrimination that Jews face is less in some respects than African Americans face because Jews can maybe hide by changing their name or doing other things what their background is, when blacks couldn't really do that. But there's still plenty of discrimination. And the anti-Semitism, which has now arisen in the United States and around the world, is probably as virulent as it has been in almost any time in history. The anti-Semitism in Europe is so terrible that many Jews have moved out of Israel, and moved to Israel from France or from England. Whereas you would think civilized countries like France and England would have a really enlightened view towards Jews, but that's not the case. The panacea for most Jews has been the United States.
Yeah.
United States, Jews have risen to the top of almost every profession and done quite well, but that's not the case all over the world. In many cases, Jews are really held back a bit. That's why Israel thrives a bit, because many Jews got tired of trying to be something successful in their own countries. They would move to Israel.
We ask every guest this question, David. Was there a moment where you knew you made it?
Well, I still don't think I've made it because I always look at other people and say, hey, they're more successful than me. So I'm still, you know, working hard. I'm 74 years old. I'm still working at many different things. And I don't really feel I've made it because I compare myself to people who are much more successful. And I say, look what they've done and look what I did compared to them.
I mean, the irony of that is we do the same thing. David and I do that all the time. We're not doing enough. We're not building enough. We don't have enough.
And every guest we've had.
And every guest we've had.
I said the same thing.
And incredible guests, you know, like you,
have all said, enormously successful.
Still hasn't felt that yet. So Big Shot is sort of part documentary and part kibitzing in a Jewish deli. And so I'd be remiss not to ask you one thing, because one thing that I think you've done very well, beyond business success and philanthropic success, is everyone that our mutual friends, let's say, have said that you've raised three incredible children. They're ambitious, they're kind, they're smart, they're thoughtful. David and I are both young dads, young parents. Any advice on parenting that you have felt has worked really well?
It's very difficult to be a parent when you're wealthy because you can easily spoil your children. So the trick is, in my view, not to flash your money, not to be arrogant, not to avoid the things you should do as a parent and being with them and trying to educate them. But in the end, children learn the most by looking at people as role models. And you have to do what you want your kids to do. There are three ways you can influence people as a leader. You can be a great speaker and say, follow me. I'm Martin Luther King. Follow me. Or you can be a great writer and you could be Abraham Lincoln. Write the Gettysburg Address and listen to what I wrote. Or you can lead by example. George Washington, Valley Forge, stayed there with his troops. If you're a parent, telling your kids what to do or sending them a note probably is not as effective as doing what you want them to do. You work hard, they're going to work hard. You obey certain rules, they're going to obey certain rules. If you break the rules or you do things you don't want your kids to do, that's not good. If you say to your kids, don't smoke, but you're smoking, you know, what do you think your kids are going to do? Or don't drink alcohol, and you drink a lot of alcohol, what are your kids going to do?
Yeah.
So I think you should try to do what you want your kids to do, but being a role model and doing those things as opposed to just telling them something.
Yeah. Last question before we let you go. What does chutzpah mean to you?
Chutzpah is a Yiddish word for boldness or willingness to take risks that other people might not take and a little bit out of the norm. So obviously anybody that's an entrepreneur has some chutzpah because by definition, if you didn't, you wouldn't start the company because who would think that you could start Facebook or Apple or whatever company it might be, if you didn't have some chutzpah.
Is it a positive or a negative term?
If you're Jewish, I think the word chutzpah is good. If you're anti-Semitic, you probably say chutzpah is not a great thing. But I think, as a general rule of thumb, the equivalent of chutzpah in whatever non-Yiddish word it might be, which is probably a good thing. Because if people didn't have leadership chutzpah, the world would be very boring and things wouldn't get done and things wouldn't change.
Yeah. When David and I first decided to start this archive, to start Big Shot, we set as an example one day we'd love to have David Rubenstein on and hear your story. David and I are proud Jewish leaders, Jewish entrepreneurs, a little bit younger than you, but you should know that we stand on the shoulders of giants like yours in our own ambition in terms of how we build our communities, our cities, and our companies. And we are very grateful that you decided to talk to us.
Well, you guys are very good interviewers.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much. Okay, thanks a lot. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now.